May it please the court, Chief Justice Hebekin, members of the court, my name is Brad Roth. I represent the appellant, Amy Kranewitter. One of the main issues in this case is whether the appellant was improperly seized pursuant to the Fourth Amendment, and we certainly would suggest that she was. One of the first determinations a court needs to make certainly is when determining that issue is whether this was a Tier 1 or a Tier 2 seizure. And we would submit that the evidence is clear that this was a Tier 2 seizure. Obviously, the trial court determined differently, but in reviewing the facts, you can be seen that what happened in this case, that a reasonable person in the appellant's position or a reasonable person would have not felt free to leave based upon what occurred.
Do you quarrel with any of the trial court's findings of historical fact?
Well, there was very few findings of historical fact. There was a ruling, it was from the bench. It was approximately, if you read the Bill of Exceptions, it's a two-thirds of a page. So it was mainly findings of law. I think the finding of fact was that the court agreed with what the officer had said. And if we look at what the officer said, I think that will show a Tier 2 seizure.
So no disagreement then as to the historical facts?
Well, for the majority of them, I don't have any disagreements. I mean, if you look at the video along with what was said by the officer, what occurred was when Ms. Kranewitter pulled into the driveway, the officer, the deputy, pulled right behind her within 5 feet. If you look at the video, those curbs on both sides of the driveway, the only way that she would have been able to leave would have been if she'd have pulled forward, backed over the curbs, onto the grass, onto the sidewalk. I think it's pretty clear that there's no way that a reasonable person would have felt they could have left under those circumstances. I don't think any person in this room would have felt with an officer 5 feet behind you in a drive that you'd had to pull over the side that they would have been free to leave, which certainly makes it a Tier 2 seizure. Now, if the officer clearly could have pulled up on the curb if he just wanted to talk to her and walked up to her, but that's not what he did. He pulled in right behind her. So
in essence, this is a one-lane driveway.
It's a two-lane driveway, but she pulled into the middle. He pulled, if you look at the video, pretty much directly behind her. I mean, he pulled a little bit to the side, but again, she could not have gotten out without going over the curbs.
I think the state's primary argument is there was no actual submission to authority here, that she sort of voluntarily put herself parked the car in the driveway in that position and stopped. What's your response to that?
Well, too, I mean, submission is that she couldn't. There's nothing that her submission was she didn't move. She didn't try to pull away.
But was she already there and stopped before the officer pulled up?
She was. I mean, she stopped and then she pulled back and then she pulled back in when the officer was pulling in. So I guess you could argue that by pulling back and pulling back in, there was a submission. But maybe more, I'm sorry, Judge.
All I was going to ask is the finding of Tier 1 versus Tier 2 essentially the linchpin? If it's Tier 1, you're in trouble. If it's Tier 2, that's what your argument ultimately depends on.
Well, that's certainly for that issue. It has to be, I would suggest, a Tier 2 in order for my argument to work. And Judge, back to your point, not only did she submit by stopping and not moving, when the officer got out of her vehicle, got out of his vehicle, there was a passenger getting out, and he says to the passenger, get back into the car. Get back into the car. That's a submission in itself as well, by telling the passenger to get back in the car.
Was there some question about when that statement was made?
I don't believe so. If you look at the Bill of Exceptions, the officer says, as I got out of the car, I told the passenger was getting out, and I told the passenger to get back into the car. Bill of Exceptions is very clear. Now, I wasn't the trial attorney, but looking at the Bill of Exceptions, it's very clear what the officer said. And then as he walked up to the car, that's when he turns on his audio and video, and that's when he goes to the driver's side, and then that's where he begins discussing what occurred with Ms. Kranewitter. So I think the evidence is clear that when the officer got out of his car and before he had any suspicion of anything wrong, that that's when he told the passenger to get back. So I would suggest that's a submission as well, Your Honor, in addition to her not moving. Now, assuming this is a Tier 2, which again I would strongly suggest it was, the next question would be, was there reasonable suspicion by the officer that a crime had been committed or was going to be committed? Now, most importantly to that determination, I think, is what the deputy says in his testimony. And what the deputy says in his testimony, he says nothing about him thinking a crime had been committed. Now, I realize the trial court says that's what he felt was what the determination should be, but the officer says the only thing I was trying to do was help her if she was lost or help them if they were lost. He mentions nothing about in his testimony that he thinks that some kind of crime was being committed. And that makes sense if you look at the video and you look at the record, because she did nothing wrong. I mean, she was driving correctly. There was certainly no erratic driving whatsoever. She didn't violate any crimes. He ran her plates. There was nothing that indicated there was a suspended license. If she was from Lincoln, this was in Waverly. There was nothing to indicate there had been crime in the area, that they suspected there was crime in the area. So there was no reason for him to suspect any type of criminal activity. And again, that's what he said. The only reason that I drove up behind her is because I thought she was potentially lost. And again, the reason he said...
Isn't that an argument that this was really a Tier 1 stop?
Well, I think you look at what his actions were to determine whether it was a Tier 1 or Tier 2, and again, back to what a reasonable person would have thought. And when he pulls in behind, if one of us is sitting in a car and an officer pulls behind us within 5 feet and we can't get out by moving either side, and then that officer says, "You get back in your car," I think any reasonable person would say, "I'm not going anywhere today. I'm not leaving, because the first thing that happens if I try to leave, he's going to be doing all kinds of stuff."
Does it matter to your argument if the court were to conclude this commenced as a Tier 1 and morphed into a Tier 2?
Well, again, I think it began as a Tier 1, because when he... I don't know that makes a difference. It seems to me that he did nothing.
Well, the pivotal Tier 2 is when they conduct a traffic stop, right?
Right.
Well, is there a traffic stop here?
Well,
the vehicle's parked in a driveway. He approaches the vehicle. There's no evidence that she sees him approach until he gets out of the vehicle and walks up. No evidence the car's in gear. No evidence the car's backing up. The reverse lights are on. None of that evidence is in place. Car's parked in a driveway.
Correct.
So this is not a traffic stop.
It's not a traffic stop. Well, it is in the sense that the car can't leave. This court in Rivera...
Is there any evidence that the car tried to leave, that it had intent to leave?
We don't know. He didn't give it a chance to leave. In Rivera, a very recent case from this court, the court said, well, there was nothing in Rivera that said the person was obstructed from moving, and there was nothing to indicate there was gestures to indicate the person should stop from moving. That's exactly what happened in this case. He prevented her from moving, and then there was a direction to get back in the car. So that's a reason. It goes back to the Tier 2. Does a reasonable person think the totality of circumstances, they're not free to leave? I can't imagine anyone at that point would have thought they were free to leave under those circumstances.
If we analogize it to the person who's standing in the driveway as opposed to in a car, and the officer simply says, "I want to talk to you," that's not a Tier 2 stop, is it?
I don't think so. But he's not blocking her from leaving.
Even if the person turns and heads towards the house to go in, and the officer says, "Stop, I want to talk to you," that's not a Tier 2, is it?
Well, I think we're getting closer to a Tier 2.
We may be getting closer, but are we there yet?
I would suggest we would be if he's
afraid. Have we ever said that in our case law?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right.
But we don't have a case where there's a 2-ton police cruiser blocking and then an instruction, "Dude, get back into your car." I don't believe any reasonable person would have thought they were free to leave at that point with that instruction, with them not being able to back out in any manner. Appreciate it, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiss, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Nathan Wiss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellate State of Nebraska. I incorrectly assumed we would be focusing on the denial of the motion for a new trial. Since the sole focus was the motion to suppress, I'll follow suit. The issue is whether the seizure of Kranewitter's vehicle was lawful. The state maintains that it was. Set forth in our brief, we agree with the district court that the initial encounter here was arguably just a consensual encounter, not even a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. The record reflects that prior to this initial contact, Ms. Kranewitter pulled into the driveway in question and parked on her own before the officer had even pulled up and pulled in behind her and made contact with her.
Was it tier one or tier two?
Since it appears there really was no submission to authority here, which is generally required for a seizure to occur, we would submit that arguably there was no seizure here, just as in Rivera.
What about the directions given to the passenger?
As I reviewed the record, the officer did clearly testify that immediately upon getting out of his vehicle, he instructed the passenger to get back in the vehicle. It's undisputed. He did say that. But as I reviewed that video, it did not appear that occurred. If I recall the video correctly, the door was just barely cracked. The officer got in front of his cruiser and just was kind of headed that direction, but then immediately turned back and went toward Ms. Kranewitter's window on the driver's side of the vehicle. I just didn't see any evidence that that occurred. And the point that I made in brief was that the officer simply could have been mistaken as to the timing of that, because later when he's talking with Ms. Kranewitter, the gentleman in the passenger seat was attempting to open the door and maybe even had his foot out, and the officer told him to get back into the vehicle, and he may have been misremembering when he made that statement. So I'm not sure that the record actually reflects that the officer made that statement initially right when he got out of the car, and as we pointed out in our brief, the district court didn't make a finding to that effect. That did in fact happen immediately upon the officer getting out of the car. If the court had thought that that happened, I guess I would be surprised that it would find this to be a tier one consensual encounter, because that would tend to lead us down the path of a tier two encounter, I would think, if an officer immediately gets out of the cruiser and says, hey, get back to your car. I mean, that I think pretty quickly moves us in the direction of a tier two. Given that, to me, the record doesn't reflect that, I think we would submit it was Tier 1. I don't...
Let's suppose it was moving in the direction of the Tier 2. Then where are we?
We would submit that if this was a Tier 2, that it was justified based on the circumstances. The officer, and we can walk through him, he observes this vehicle. It's 6 a.m. It's parked in front of one of his neighbors. His neighbor's driveway. He's familiar with vehicles that come and go from this residence. He's never seen this vehicle. He knows
it's not the neighbor.
He knows it's not the neighbor. The neighbors that live next to him are a 70-year-old gal and her 96-year-old mother. This is a younger gal who's in this vehicle in question.
Strange car in a neighborhood.
It's
anything else?
Well, he is watching it, and then as he is driving away, he has enough of a concern that he decides to come back, and as he's driving back, Ms. Kranewitter's vehicle, I don't know if you've seen the video, but her vehicle is nearly out of the driveway, and he's approaching, coming down the street, and her vehicle, I would say, pretty much shoots back up into the driveway pretty quickly, and then all the way up into the driveway. You might have circumstances where maybe you're backing out and a car is coming, your tail end's hanging out, and you just kind of pull back in so the other car can pass. I mean, that clearly is not what happened here upon a review of the video.
The defendant's vehicle was never on a public roadway in the view of this officer.
He saw it. I believe he testified that he saw it pull into the driveway, if I recall the record correctly. But the video does reflect that she was, her vehicle was partially hanging out onto the road. I think about half of the vehicle was probably out onto the roadway as she was approaching, and then it pulled back up into the driveway.
Does that make it a stop? If she was trying to leave the driveway, saw the officer turn around to come back to her, and then she pulled into the driveway and he pulled in behind her, doesn't that make it a little more like a Tier 2 than a Tier 1?
I think it's relevant. I don't know that that in and of itself would make it a stop, because it's not as if she saw him and was yielding to his authority and pulled into the driveway as if she was being pulled over. I mean, it looked to me more from the video that they were backing out and saw an officer and just pulled back up into the driveway and parked. And if I recall the video correctly, yeah, I mean, there was no reverse lights on this vehicle, and I think the passenger's door was cracked.
Was there any finding with respect to that issue of whether or not the vehicle was on a public roadway?
Any finding?
Yeah.
With respect to that? I don't recall. Well, I guess there was, within the elements instruction, the jury was instructed that these are the elements of DUI, and one of which was that the vehicle was on a public roadway. So, yes, it was a factual finding.
Implicit in the order on suppression?
Was it
implicit on the suppression, order on suppression, that the vehicle was on a public roadway? Necessarily implied by the ruling?
On the suppression ruling?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would say that it was implicit. I don't know that it would be required, though. I mean, if you have a suspicion of criminal activity, we're not limited to just a DUI that would have to occur on a public roadway.
What would the criminal activity be here?
Well, he didn't know. That was the point. He thought perhaps the vehicle was just lost, but he also said that the situation seemed suspicious given the circumstances.
Was there evidence that the officer noticed the black Altima driving slowly down the street and then saw it pull into the driveway? Was that part of the evidence? I
believe so, but I don't recall at this moment, Your Honor. I don't want to misrepresent the record, but that is my recollection, is that that's what he observed. And then he continued watching in his rearview mirror as he was driving away and was watching the vehicle in the driveway, and it was just parked there. And as he was driving away, and it just continued to just remain parked there, he had concern and question as to whether or not this was somebody who was just lost, or whether it was potentially something else going on that was awry, and that's why he decided to come back.
What is the criminal activity? Is it drunk driving? Is it burglary? What's the criminal activity that he had reasonable suspicion of?
He wasn't sure. I mean,
so how do we know it's not? How is it more than a hunch?
Well, I mean, to me, generally, a hunch is just sort of, you're looking at a vehicle and you think, they might be up to no good, I'm going to stop them and see. Whereas here, I mean, you do have articulable facts that he's pointing to, and sure, it's not overwhelming. It's maybe it's not even a classic case of seeing something where it immediately stands out as being,
Couldn't the criminal activity be trespass?
It could be any number of things if the vehicle is not supposed to be there. The point of investigative stops is to make an investigation. You don't have to, your belief doesn't have to be any more right than wrong. It's just you have to have a legitimate basis to make contact with the individual or individuals in question. And here he had a basis. I don't think looking at his observations and his personal familiarity with this neighborhood, it doesn't strike me as unreasonable that he would make contact with this vehicle.
Did he have an unusual car operating in an unusual manner at an unusual time?
I don't know if I would describe the vehicle as being operated in an unusual manner, but everything else, yes, the car was out of place. It's very early in the morning. These women, according to the officer, typically are not awake till 8:30 a.m. You've never seen this vehicle. It's just sitting there for a period of time as he's driving away, and then as he comes back, I mean, that's one thing. It did stand out to me as I watched that video, because I was having all these same concerns. Is there really anything out of place here? But it stuck out to me when I'm watching that video, the way that the vehicle pulled back into the driveway. It definitely seemed odd. Had I been that officer, that alone would have given me pause.
Do you think it suggested flight from the officer?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it suggested flight. I mean, that was my initial impression, was that when I watched it, that they saw that they were you know, the officer had left, and okay, all right, now we're going to leave, and they saw him coming back, and you know, oh crap, the officer's coming back, and because they went back up into that driveway pretty quickly, which so that was the impression I had.
Would it be fair to characterize it more as a desire not to have an encounter rather than flight?
Well, probably. I mean, you couldn't flee too far here other than straight into the garage. So, yes, I suppose so. But, I think the takeaway from that is the same in the sense of would it give an officer some legitimate basis to think, okay, maybe they're up to no good.
Second issue, can you address that?
Yeah. On the motion for new trial, and I'll be as brief as I can here, same amount of time, the issue here is whether the defect in the certificate of the analysis, if known prior to trial, would have rendered this breath test inadmissible. We maintain that it would not have, so new trial was not warranted. As set forth in the briefs, the primary question here is whether this defect in the certificate would have negated the necessary foundation for the admissibility of the breath test. We submit that it wouldn't have, given that the defect was minor. Law enforcement in the state of Nebraska had no role in that mistake, and then we got an amended certificate with the corrected information soon
Is
after.
Is the amended certificate testimonial?
Is it testimonial?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't believe so. Well, first of all, with respect to that, just briefly, I'm not sure where that challenge gets the defense, because the amended certificate is not what led to, that's not what was introduced at trial. There was no objection on confrontation at all at trial anyway, so I'm not sure that this issue is even preserved, but the amended certificate didn't come in at trial either, so to the extent they're saying that would present a confrontation problem, I guess I fail to see how it does since that didn't come in at trial. But in any event, to answer your question, no, I don't think so. I don't see how that one is any more why that one would be testimonial any more than the original one. I mean, it's offered or presented to the state for the same purpose, simply to provide law enforcement with the simulator solution and to inform them of the value so they can run their tests and determine that their machine is running properly. I don't see any basis to conclude that this amended one, any more than the original, is being created in anticipation of trial. I don't think that's the case, and I think the record reflects that they continued to use the simulator solution, at least for a period of time, with the amended certificate to maintain the breath testing machine in question. So I don't think there's any basis to conclude it's prepared in anticipation of trial. I think that Britt and Fisher would apply equally with respect to the amended certificate, just as they would the original.
Is Title 177 complied with? Was that inaccurate or misstated affidavit?
I would submit that it was complied with. I mean, obviously we have the defect that's undisputed, but in terms of what the state is doing, we got the simulation solution, we had the certificate of analysis, unbeknownst to us there was a defect in it, but I mean, we did what we were supposed to do to comply with Title 177, and you know, ultimately upon learning of that defect, we do what we need to do to get it corrected. But I don't see, I mean, we have a certificate with all of the requisite information.
Just the wrong information.
Right, but I don't think, at least from the state's end, and the actions that Title 177 is telling us to take, I don't think that the state failed to comply with anything, any of the directives of Title 177.
Any reason to believe the simulator solution was inaccurate?
No, and that's really the essence of our argument here, is that you look at the foundational requirements, the first and primary requirement is that the testing device is working properly, and there's really, I guess I shouldn't say there's no dispute, but I don't think there's much room for dispute here that everything was working properly. I mean, there's no evidence that the simulator solution was off. There's no evidence that the breath testing machine itself was off. No evidence that the test itself that was conducted on this craniometer was in any way problematic. So I don't see any problems with the reliability here of anything. It was simply a defect in this document, and I just don't see how that affects anything here, so I don't think it leads to a conclusion that we didn't comply or that we didn't have the necessary foundation for admission of that chemical breath test.
If the new trial was granted on this newly discovered evidence, and the next trial is held, and this new evidence is admitted into the record, that will not preclude the use of the toxilizer results, would it?
if they were to use the amended certificate rather than the original?
Yeah, if the newly discovered evidence that's in question here is used in the new trial, would that result in the toxilizer evidence being inadmissible?
I don't believe so. I don't see why it would.
It would just replace the foundational document that previously preceded it, would it not?
I believe so. And, you know, when you look at a case like State v. Obermeyer, I didn't cite that in my brief, but it's from 1992. That was a case where the officer's Class B permit wasn't introduced into trial, and this court explained that that's not fatal. You didn't necessarily need the document. The officer's testimony alone could be sufficient to lay the necessary foundation. So I don't know that the document itself is even critical. If you want that citation, it's, again, the State v. Obermeyer, it's 241 Nev 802 from 1992. I just don't see how the defect in question here was material. It didn't affect anything here with respect to the reliability of the process or the results or the machine. Really have nothing further to add. If the court has no further questions, we would ask you to come to the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
12 seconds, Your Honor.
12 seconds, Mr. Roth. We will give you 3 minutes and 12 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief, or fairly brief. With regard to the question about did the officer tell him, the passenger, to stay in the car or not, I mean, the argument from the state was, well, the evidence isn't clear. Well, yes, it is. The officer testified, clearly when I got out of the car, I told that passenger to get back in the car. The reason that it may not have been captured on video, because the officer goes on to say that as I was walking up to the talk with the driver, that's when I turned on my video or my audio. So the reason that it likely wasn't captured is because he indicated, he testified he hadn't turned everything on at that
point. Does the video capture him saying the same thing later?
I think he did say it. I don't recall for sure, Your Honor, but I believe he did say it later twice. But he testified clearly and uncontroverted that when I got out of my vehicle, I told the passenger to get back, which just makes sense because he said the passenger was starting to get out, and that's when he would have told him. But there was no other evidence otherwise that he did not do that and told the passenger to get back in.
Could you speak to the defective certificates?
Sure.
Thank you.
With regard to the certificates, there was a question, did it violate Title 177? Sure it did. Sure it did. There was a perjured certificate that was offered at the trial. No one knew it at that point, but there was a perjured certificate. Alma Palmer indicated that she had tested the solution and she had not. The officer Powell, who was the maintenance director at the motion for new trial hearing, testified, I wouldn't have certified it if I'd have known it was false. In addition to that, Title 177 says when that solution comes from wherever to be with the solutions, there has to be the certificate of analysis. A valid certificate of analysis has to come with the solution. This wasn't a valid certificate of analysis. It was a falsified, perjured certificate of analysis. So would the result have been different if we'd have got to that evidence in a new trial? Well, sure, it might have been. We got perjured evidence from the person who did it. You can't go back now and say, okay, now we have somebody who says it's okay, because at the time that solution came to Lancaster County, the certificate was no good. The maintenance officer could not have certified that solution when he did so. So you get into the method technique, which gets very complicated. It's always hard maybe to differentiate the two, but in this case I would say it's closer to a method in that that was incorrect in the fact that you have to test the solution through the machine. That's a laboratory analysis to confirm that the machine is operating properly. If you got a bad certificate, that you have nothing to measure the solution that you're testing again, I would suggest that's a method issue as opposed to technique. And therefore, we believe that would have made a difference if it had been known that there was a falsified, perjured certificate of analysis. And therefore, we're requesting the court to reverse the conviction of Ms. Cranwither. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus Amaya. Justice Breitberg is recused from this matter.